Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Afghan government officials said Wednesday that reclusive Taliban chief Mullah Omar is dead, that he died more than 2 years ago in Pakistan. He was very sick in a Karachi hospital and died suspiciously there, Abdul Hasib Siddiqui, the spokesman for Afghanistan's main intelligence agency, the National Directorate of Security, said. He did not explain what was suspicious about the death or say how long his agency had possessed information about Omar's fate. President Ashraf Ghani's office also said Omar died in 2013, but the Taliban itself claimed that Omar is still alive. In the aftermath of the 2001 attacks, the U.S. government offered large rewards for the capture of many al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. A $10 million bounty was offered for Mullah Omar. Turkish warplanes bombarded Kurdish militants in northern Iraq Wednesday, hours after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said it was impossible to continue peace efforts with the Kurds. Ankara's fighter jets hit shelters, depots, and caves in six areas, Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu's office said. It was the biggest assault since Turkey launched strikes last week against the Kurdish militants and Islamic State fighters in northern Syria. Iraq condemned the air attacks as a dangerous escalation and an assault on Iraqi sovereignty. Mr. Davutoğlu has called the fight against the Kurds and Islamic State a synchronized fight against terror. But Turkey's assaults so far have been heaviest against Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK targets in Iraq and in southeastern Turkey. This is VOA News. Turkey's president is meeting top officials in China to strengthen ties that have been strained over the delayed sale of a Chinese missile system and Beijing's treatment of its Turkic-speaking Uyghur minority. After landing in Beijing on Wednesday, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan met with Chinese Premier Li Keqiang and is also expected to confer with President Xi Jinping following a formal ceremony. Eurotunnel, the company operating the tunnel between France and England, says it has blocked more than 37,000 migrants trying to cross illegally from continental Europe to Britain since the beginning of the year. Eurotunnel announced the total Wednesday, saying France and Britain need to do more to help Eurotunnel cope with the rising numbers of migrants flooding into the area. The Democratic Republic of Congo's biggest ever corruption probe was called off without an official explanation, according to both a Congolese lawmaker and a government spokesman. Investigators were looking into fraud that may have cost the government more than $3 billion. For VOA, Nick Long has more.
This was an investigation of alleged corruption over 4 years, from 2009 to 2013, in the customs service of Katanga province in southeastern DRC. Katanga is the source of most of the DRC's mineral exports and a powerhouse for the rest of the economy. Last week, opposition lawmaker Mushizi Kizito called for a judicial inquiry into the alleged corruption to be restarted. Kizito says he does not know who denounced what exactly, but there was information indicating serious corruption and fraud, and Minister Mende sent a letter about this to the Justice Ministry. It is not clear how much money there is left to recover, nor is it clear if anyone in the Customs Service has been punished for the alleged fraud. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Bangladesh's Supreme Court upheld a death sentence against opposition leader Salahuddin Qadir Chaudhry on Wednesday in connection with mass killings during the country's 1971 war for independence from Pakistan. Chaudhry is a leader of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party and was an aide to former Prime Minister Khalida Zia. And Chaudhry denied the charges, saying he was not in the country at the time, but the tribunal said evidence proved otherwise. The United Nations Security Council is scheduled to vote Wednesday on a draft resolution establishing an international tribunal to try those suspected of shooting down a Malaysia Airlines plane over eastern Ukraine a year ago. On July 17, 2014, Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, with 298 passengers on board, about two-thirds of them Dutch, was hit by a surface-to-air missile over the eastern Ukraine region held by Russian-backed separatists. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
As health officials in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone struggle to eliminate the final cases of Ebola, a new report says some hard lessons have been learned. The group, International Alert, says a lack of trust between the Liberian people and their government made the...
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also, as many as 10,000 migrants from Africa, the Middle East, and beyond are living in squalid encampments in and near the city of Calais in France. And according to media reports, the Nigerian army has repelled an attack by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram on Baratai, the hometown of the new army chief of staff.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Reuters Newswire reports that a Sudanese migrant was killed early today trying to cross from France to Britain through the Channel, the tunnel under the English Channel. Authorities say the man was between 20 to 25 years old. He was likely struck by a truck. A Eurotunnel spokesman says that there were about 1,500 attempts by migrants to access the tunnel Tuesday after 2,000 attempts the previous night.
Eurotunnel says it has blocked more than 37,000 migrants trying to cross illegally from continental Europe to Britain since the beginning of the year. As many as 10,000 migrants from Africa, the Middle East, and beyond are living in squalid encampments in near Calais, France. Observers say their push to enter the 50-kilometer undersea tunnel has intensified in recent weeks after authorities stepped up port security to block migrants from stowing away on Britain-bound vessels.
In Nigeria, the media say the army has repelled an attack by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram on Baratai. The Borno State village is the hometown of the new army chief of staff, Major General Tukur Baratai, and the site of a military camp. Nigeria's Guardian newspaper says the insurgents attacked at about 3:30 Tuesday morning. The paper says the army also turned back an attack on Baratai Monday evening. The Guardian says it's the fourth attack on the village since February. The director of army relations, Colonel Sani Kukasheka Usman, told the paper that the situation and town is cool and calm.
In a related story, the Daily Trust paper says police defused a bomb yesterday evening at a crowded market along Baga Road in Maiduguri. The paper says a businessman discovered the bomb and alerted the police. Meanwhile, the Sun newspaper says the military on Monday rescued 30 civilians in the Borno central town of Dikwa, which was recently liberated by troops. The army says the hostages were being held in Kwakibe and Wuef ward in Dikwa local government. Among them were 21 children, a 6-day-old infant, 7 women and 2 elderly men. The army spokesman says authorities also discovered a shed in the looted palace of the Shehu of Dikwa, where recruits were given weapons, training and instruction on how to engage aircraft.
Well, during President Obama's visit to Africa this week, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, MCC, announced a $70 million new commitment to bring $1 billion in public-private investments to developing countries over the next 5 years. A large portion of the grant money will go to Africa and is expected to generate $750 million in investments in Africa from the private sector. Kie Kim is Deputy Vice President of Compact Operations for the MCC. She spoke with me about how the money will be invested.
The MCC is going to typically invest in large-scale infrastructure projects. It's about two-thirds of our portfolio. Within the infrastructure portfolio, we will help prepare some of the projects for the market such that private companies would find them attractive and be interested in investing alongside some of these projects. And this would result in public-private partnerships that would hopefully increase the effectiveness of the operations and maintenance of these various investments, as well as catalyze private sector funding to help increase the benefits of the public sector investments that we contribute to. An example of this would be something that we did in Jordan with a wastewater treatment plant where MCC came in with about $93 million in grant financing, and we were able to partner with a private sector consortium that contributed about $110 million. And so with this over $200 million, we're able to expand a wastewater treatment plant, providing increased water supply to the Jordanians.
Are these the same types of projects that you're looking at in Africa as well, or what are some of those investments that you're looking at in Africa?
Yeah, similar projects in Africa where we would be catalyzing private sector investment, particularly for infrastructure. An example of this, we're investing quite heavily in the energy sector, and so there are lots of opportunities for the private sector to come in to contribute to increased generation of electricity in these countries.
Of the $52 million that is going to be generated for Africa, are there any particular countries that you have in mind, or how will that money be dispersed in Africa?
The funding is actually going to be allocated through the compacts, some of our existing compacts, as well as some of our compacts in the pipeline. On that list, our investments in Africa include Malawi, Benin, Lesotho, Liberia, Tanzania, Ghana, and Morocco. There are other countries that we're investing as well, but in those countries that I just listed, those are probably have the largest opportunities for public-private partnerships.
What do African countries need to do to overcome the challenges that they're facing now to accelerate economic growth?
I think our country partners are very good examples of countries that are doing the right things to reduce poverty, increase economic growth, attract private sector investment. These are countries that have a good track record in terms of good governance and democracy, have strong efforts towards anti-corruption, are investing in their social sectors and education and health, as well as creating an enabling business environment through things like good fiscal policy, trade policy. For example, as I mentioned, we're invested quite heavily in the energy sector. We are part of the U.S. government Power Africa initiative, committing about $2 billion to that initiative. In the countries where we work, for example, in Benin, they're working very hard to modernize their policies to allow for more private sector investment, to strengthen the utility companies so that they perform better and perform better for their customers and are also financially viable.
You say you're expected to generate $750 million in investments in Africa within the next 5 years. So given that, where do you see Africa in 5 years in terms of reducing poverty?
I'm 100% optimist when it comes to Africa. When you hear about 6 out of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa, I think that there's tremendous growth opportunity there. So I see in 5 years, definitely much more interest by private sector from countries that traditionally have not invested in Africa. And what we're trying to do is really increase the visibility of U.S. companies in Africa.
That was Kay Kim, Deputy Vice President of Compact Operations for the Millennium Challenge Corporation. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Ruhib. 14 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. As many as 10,000 migrants from Africa, the Middle East and beyond are living in squalid encampments in and near the city of Calais in France. And according to media reports, the Nigerian army has repelled an attack by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram on Baratai, hometown of the new army chief of staff. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
While cases of Ebola continue to linger in West Africa, the World Health Organization says in the reporting period ending July 26th, there were 7 confirmed cases, 4 in Guinea and 3 in Sierra Leone. It's the lowest weekly total in more than a year. Recent weekly reporting periods had been between 20 and 30 cases. The WHO says the decline in cases is welcome, but it's not clear whether it can be sustained. It warns just one high-risk case or missed contact can trigger a new cluster of cases. Liberia's vice president called for financial support for a sub-regional recovery plan for Ebola-affected countries. Joseph Boakai spoke yesterday at the International Conference on Africa's Fight Against Ebola. He said for Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone and the region to fully recover will cost about $8 billion. About half of that would go towards the sub-regional recovery plan that includes rebuilding healthcare systems. The Liberian vice president joined the Economic Commission for Africa and the AU in calling for debt relief as part of recovery efforts.
As health officials in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone struggle to eliminate the final cases of Ebola, a new report says some hard lessons have been learned. The Group International Alert says a lack of trust between the Liberian people and their government made the outbreak worse. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The report's author, Ashoka Mukpo, says that many people mistrust official institutions and even feel threatened by them. Mukpo, an American, is an Ebola survivor himself. He contracted the disease last year in Monrovia.
It was a bad couple of weeks. I was very, very sick. I've never been that sick in my life, and I was quite scared.
After being treated for 5 days in Liberia, he was airlifted to a medical facility in the U.S. state of Nebraska. The International Alert Report is entitled Surviving Ebola: Public Perceptions of Governance and the Outbreak Response in Liberia.
You know, International Alert is an organization that looks at underlying dynamics to maintain peace in fragile states. And one of the things we're really curious about with the Ebola outbreak in Liberia is how much did people's perceptions towards government contribute to the outbreak? And what we found when we talked to people is that there were very high levels of mistrust and suspicion towards the government's motives. And this was really what underpinned people's initial refusal to take their warning seriously about how deadly Ebola was.
He says the mistrust stems from history and unfulfilled expectations.
On one hand, Liberia has quite a history of tension between citizens and government. It had a civil war about 15 years ago. But I think right now what people felt is that there was this tremendous sense of hope that with President Johnson Sirleaf's election, this would mean development and accountability for corruption and these kind of things. And the results have actually been quite disappointing. So people are savvy enough to see that what they were hoping would happen hasn't actually happened.
Mukpo says Liberians had expected more from the healthcare system when the Ebola outbreak took hold.
People felt like so many millions of dollars have gone into aid and development over the past 10 years, and for the health sector to completely collapse so quickly, there was this perception that, well, there must have been some kind of corruption, that people were taking money and not putting it into the places it was supposed to go. So fair or not, if you look at the record of this government in battling corruption, it's been so poor that even if there were much bigger issues, you know, with how hard it is to fight an Ebola outbreak, people's perceptions automatically went to corruption.
However, perceptions were not the same for the international community.
You know, actually, I was really surprised by this. As someone who'd lived in Liberia for a few years, I really expected that the levels of trust in the international community would have been equally as low as the government, because, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, these are the folks who support this government the way that they act. But actually, the levels of trust that were given to the international community were much higher than the government. In fact, most of the remarks and most of the reports on the international community's performance during Ebola and just in general its concern for Liberians was very high.
He says one of the critical and underreported narratives of Liberia's Ebola crisis involved community leaders.
Initially, there was this really authoritative effort to quarantine communities and force them to do things differently. And it kind of didn't work. And what really worked is once you sat down with communities and once the government actually got to community leaders and said, look, what can we do to assist you in fighting this outbreak? What do you need from us and what can you do to help? Then once that kind of collaborative effort started, then that's really when you started to see cases reduce.
Mukpo says community trust played a major role in the safe burial of Ebola victims. Touching and washing dead bodies helped spread the disease, despite government warnings against the traditional practice.
Really, when you got community volunteers involved, these are the people whose neighbors were doing these secret burials, whose neighbors were hiding the sick. So it's much easier to hide somebody from an official who doesn't live in your neighborhood than from someone who grew up 30 yards away. And they come and they knock on your door and say, you know, look, I hear your sister is sick. We need to take her to the clinic. And I really think that was the tipping point, that once it was people that folks trusted and that knew had their best interests in mind, that's really when people started to be more cooperative and change their behavior.
The International Alert Report says post-Ebola policymaking and aid delivery must take into account the need to repair the bonds between Liberians and their government in order to strengthen good governance and accountability. It adds that projects that seek to strengthen health services, promote good governance, and rebuild service delivery must incorporate civil society and communities into planning and decision-making. It also recommends that security forces exercise restraint during demonstrations and protests, that anti-corruption agencies be strengthened, and that the Liberian government support a free press and civil society. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The DRC's biggest ever corruption probe was called off without an official explanation, according to both a Congolese lawmaker and the government spokesman. Investigators were looking to fraud that may have cost the government $3 billion. Nick Long has more.
This was an investigation of alleged corruption over 4 years, from 2009 to 2013, in the customs service of Katanga province in southeastern DRC. Katanga is the source of most of the DRC's mineral exports and a powerhouse for the rest of the economy. Last week, opposition lawmaker Mushizi Kizito called for a judicial inquiry into the alleged corruption to be restarted. Speaking to VOA, he said the investigation was launched in 2013 after Communications Minister Lambert Mende heard accusations about the service. Kizito says he does not know who denounced what exactly, but there was information indicating serious corruption and fraud, and Minister Mende sent a letter about this to the Justice Ministry. This led to the state prosecutor sending a team of investigators to Katanga in September 2013. According to Kizito, the team managed in only 10 days to recover some $700 million in unpaid customs and other taxes. But he said the team was then recalled to Kinshasa before it had examined most of the relevant documents for the period. Mende confirmed to VOA that he initiated the investigators' mission to Katanga. I don't know if they recovered any money, he tells VOA, adding they did identify large amounts of tax owed that had not been paid. But the mission was terminated abruptly, we don't know by whom. Anyway, it would be worth reopening the inquiry, he says. Kizito says the team recovered more than $700 million, but adds that was far less than the estimated total that was owed. It was estimated to be $3 billion, he tells VOA. 279 businesses were implicated, he says, all kinds of businesses, including companies in mining, beverages, services and import-export. $3 billion would have been a hefty proportion of the annual state budget of about $8 billion, Kizito added, and he suggested there might have been fraud on the same scale in the other 10 provinces. He cautioned that some of the estimated $3 billion might have been legal tax avoidance through transfer pricing and other means, rather than illegal tax evasion. But he said this was for prosecutors to establish, and it was a pity the DRC's first ever tax investigation on this scale had not been pursued. A Congolese organization, the African Association for the Defense of Human Rights, ASADHO, says it has access to details of the 2013 inquiry. An ASADHO activist from Katanga, Francois Katende, told VOA he could confirm that money had been recovered from companies in Katanga. He says he has a list of 10 companies that made payments after ASADHO publicized the affair. He also suggested that most of the $700 million was recovered from just two companies. As for who called a halt to the investigation in 2013, Kizito, Katende and Minister Mende all said they do not know who was responsible for that decision. It is not clear how much money there is left to recover or what has happened to any money that was recovered, nor is it clear if anyone in the Customs Service has been punished for the alleged fraud. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
3 days before U.S. President Barack Obama visited Nairobi, Kenya, the city announced it was going to relocate street children to rehabilitation centers in the country. The move coincides with a project to clean up the streets before the president's arrival. As Rael Ombura reports for VOA, many say there must be a better way to address the plight of Nairobi's street families.
Humphrey Mashare is on the streets in downtown Nairobi trying to direct a driver to an empty parking spot. The driver comes out and hands him 20 shillings, about 20 US cents, and Humphrey looks for another client. The 17-year-old is just one of the many street boys trying to survive in the city. He says the reason why he came to the streets is his stepfather was mistreating him, so he left home and started his life over in the streets. Like many on the streets, he has spent time in some government rehabilitation centers designed to give street kids another chance. But for many of the street kids, these centers can feel more like detention camps. He says that's the worst place you can ever go. He says you cannot stay there because boys run away all the time and they wake you up too early. After the White House confirmed U.S. President Barack Obama's visit to Kenya, the Nairobi governor announced that the county government had set aside about 16 hectares of land in Ruai, about 20 kilometers from the center of Nairobi, where it intended to settle city street families. The Kenyan government has budgeted only about $30,000 to fund rehabilitation of street families. Activists like Joyce Mudoni, a former street child herself, says life at the centers is often worse than on the streets. She says the rehabilitation centers are dirty with diseases. And she says when she was 12 years old, her body was swollen when she was there. Some private centers are offering another alternative. Francis Kinyo is a program officer at Undugu Society, an organization that deals with rescue, rehabilitation, and reintegration of street children into society. He says that private rehabilitation centers are more efficient than the government ones. At Undugu Society, they use an approach that is more comfortable for the children.
We rehabilitate them at where they are by giving them life skills on how they can manage the trauma that they have gone through and the issue they have faced in their lives.
Street families in Kenya face a myriad of problems. The government has recognized the need to help, but getting the street families the right kind of help is still a challenge. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbuganyi, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.